know what's going on Kenosha, framing it in your own perspective.
Yes, since I resigned, so I think of my resignation as a leap of faith, really. I mean, I had nowhere to go from Kenosha News. But I took that leap of faith, and the community that I've been covering, which is Kenosha, caught me. And if you look at my GoFundMe for unemployment, I'm over 21,000 now, and I only asked for 5,000. And I do plan on, whatever the end total is by September 14th, donating half back to the Uptown neighborhood, which was badly destroyed.
We have 10 seconds.
Throughout all this.
Go ahead.
I'll be in Kenosha. I'll stay in Kenosha, and I'll be reporting.
You're starting, and you hope to start an independent media company in Kenosha?
Yes. Yes.
Well, Daniel Thompson, I want to thank you for being with us, and I just wanted to update people. Local TV station WTMJ-TV reports Kenosha business owner declines President Trump photo op, so a foreigner owner had to come in and replace him. Daniel Thompson, former digital editor at Kenosha News, who resigned his position in protest of a headline he says mischaracterized the rally for Jacob Blake. That does it for our broadcast. I'm Amy Goodman. Wear a mask, save lives, stay safe.
KBOO Portland.
This is KBOO Portland. It is 8 a.m. and it is Wednesday. It's time for Wednesday Talk Radio Program with your host, Paul Rowland. Stay tuned to your community connection.
Hold your head.
And good morning, everybody. This is Paul Rowland calling, talking to you from my home here in Portland. And just to let you know, if you hadn't heard yet, we are entering our fall pledge drive. And we'll be talking about that the second half of the show some more. But this is a time to support a station that is increasingly important in these times, having independent local radio telling you what you're not going to hear too much elsewhere. And we're also looking for people to support us financially, but also to tell other people. We want to increase our listenership and our reach and our base of support. So, that said, the police have the motto, protect and serve, is under fire as never before. As we know, they are often very selective in who they protect and serve, and who they actually repress, suppress, and oppress. Often the selectivity is the result of the same unconscious racial, economic, and gender biases that are widespread in our culture. But as our guest Mike German points out, there are also quite a few police officers who hold more or less openly far-right white supremacist beliefs, and some even belong to violent far-right organizations. What does that mean in this time of a strange kind of emerging civil war under this proto-fascist, what are you going to call him, leader Trump, who's taking us into very dangerous territories? And since the police are there to enforce the law, they are inherently political, especially if some of them hold these extreme ideologies. So Mike German works with the Brennan Center for Justice's Liberty and National Security Program, which seeks to ensure that the U.S. government respects human rights and fundamental freedoms in conducting the fight against terrorism. A former special agent with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, German's work focuses on law enforcement, intelligence oversight, and reform. Prior to joining the Brennan Center, he served as a policy counsel for national security and privacy for the American Civil Liberties Union's Washington Legislative Office. He's authored a recent report for the center called Hidden in Plain Sight: Racism, White Supremacy, and Far-Right Militancy in Law Enforcement, which you can find a link to on my program page at kbo.fm. He also wrote a recent article for The Guardian last week on the report, and it is getting some attention in the press. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're quite welcome. It's really good. This is a great opportunity and in a very intense time, including here in Portland, which you maybe have been following some, I guess, since we're sort of in one of the epicenters of the meteor storm over this police reform or transformation movement that has been sweeping the country. So let's just get right into it.
Sure.
You've had a long experience. Maybe start with your own experience in the FBI in dealing with the far right and white supremacy.
Sure. I joined the FBI in 1988, straight out of law school, and did a lot of different things as a federal law enforcement officer. But in the early 1990s, there was a period where I was in Los Angeles, and the Los Angeles Police Department had abused a motorist named Rodney King, and there was a very large protest and some civil unrest following that, the acquittal of those officers in state court. And at the time, there were some white supremacist groups who were trying to take advantage of that civil unrest to spark a wider race war. So the FBI sent me undercover into the neo-Nazi groups to try to interdict the weapons trafficking that they were involved in. Ended up spending the rest of my career working undercover in one capacity or another, and eventually was with some far-right militia groups in the Pacific Northwest in the late 1990s. And then after 9/11, the FBI was completely changing its counterterrorism policies, and I disagreed with those and raised concerns internally that were not received well. So by 2004, I decided to resign and ended up working at the American Civil Liberties Union in Washington, D.C., lobbying and doing policy work on national security issues. And
so what,
eventually in 2014, came over to the Brennan Center, where I am now.
Uh-huh. So I guess there's so many questions. We need to get into the current situation fairly soon, but so I mean, what kind of follow through was there in the FBI to the kind of work that you did at the time? And I take it that it's changed. You said it changed under Bush, but it's maybe even changed even more now.
So it was interesting because it was very difficult. There was a very effective and stubborn case agent who thought that the white supremacist arming for a larger race war was an important thing for the FBI to be in front of, who got that case off the ground. And when it had considerable success from the FBI's point of view, number of arrests and conspiracies interdicted, I assumed that there would be an effort to replicate it, but there really wasn't. It kind of just, you know, nice pat on the back. You did a great job. Go do other work. And I was a young FBI agent, so assumed that the FBI knew what it was doing. And then in the 90s, when I did another case in the Pacific Northwest and realized that, you know, this was a model, that I used many of the same tactics in order to gain their trust so that they would involve me in their criminal activities. And again, went back to the FBI and said, you know, would you like to debrief me about how I did all this? And they again said no. So there was the idea that because those cases were successful, the FBI had its attention focused on that problem, but it really wasn't true. There were a handful of cases, just as there are now. I mean, now there are a handful of cases where some enterprising agents go out and put some good cases together. The problem is it's just not prioritized as institutionally. The FBI often breaks white supremacist violence into the civil rights category rather than the counterterrorism category, and often even in the violent crimes category. And it wouldn't really bother me too much how they do it, except that counterterrorism is the number one priority. So calling it a civil rights violation drops it to the number five priority, and calling it violent crime drops it to number six out of only eight categories. So it gives you an idea of how they're not resourced as well. Go ahead.
Well, would you be willing to venture to say that political ideology and or white supremacist core beliefs within the FBI itself might have had something to do with that?
I think it's all of the above. I think there is structural racism. The FBI is still a very white organization. The last time that they produced statistics, 83-point-something percent white and 80% male. So if you survey the average white male about what he's concerned about as far as potential threats on the horizon, you know, these aren't the type of people who are worried that white supremacists are going to invade their neighborhood and do harm to their family. So part of it is that structural racism and implicit bias, but certainly, as my report indicates, there's an acknowledgement within law enforcement and within the FBI in particular that there is white supremacist infiltration of law enforcement, and some of these ideas do play a role. And then, as you said, what we have now is where it's not just the racism that's involved, but actually politics, that we've become so polarized as a society that if you're very interested in gun rights and very interested in immigration, that in order to line up on those issues, the groups lining up with you might be much more racist than you would be, but you're still lining up with them on those issues. So I think that's part of the problem as well, that the law enforcement is, many people in law enforcement are seeing themselves on the same side of so many issues with these people who have been, and I'm talking about far-right militants, who have been very shrewd in how they adopt police culture. Dressing like the military veterans in Afghanistan and Iraq, and flying the Blue Lives Matter flag. And unfortunately, I think law enforcement doesn't understand the history or the present threat very well, because far-right militants often kill police officers. And even recently, the only two police officers killed since the George Floyd protest in some kind of political violence have been killed by far-right militants. So it's very troubling to me to see the law enforcement officers seeming to have some affinity for these far-right groups.
Well, it's kind of a paradox that it's kind of hard to wrap one's mind around, unless I guess one's done some really, really serious research into these groups like the Boogaloo Boys and stuff. I want to bracket that. Maybe we can talk about that later. I need to let our listeners know that Mike German is only going to be on for the first half hour, so we will have the whole second half hour to interact with our callers. But if you do have an extremely pertinent and relevant question, I guess that's the same thing, pertinent and relevant, to ask Mike, you can call 503-231-8187. So just let Sonia, our board operator, know what you want to talk about, and maybe you can get on the air. But after that, we'll have plenty of time to talk. So this issue of there's so many dimensions. There's a dimension of the way that you divide it between unconscious biases that, as I mentioned initially, and explicit you know, far right or ideology, which are, you know, not necessarily so separate. But so the way this can play out in the police work is obviously in the way they treat people, the way they treat their colleagues, the way they treat the people, the citizens that they deal with, or non-citizens as they may be. And but it also can take the form of favoritism. There's been several cases in Portland already where the police have been, it's been alleged that the police played favorites and treated and have treated say, the Proud Boys or some of these other groups with a lighter hand than they have the counter protesters. What kind of information about or experience with that do you have?
So, you know, because video cameras are so ubiquitous now, it's not hard to see it, right? And
right.
It's interesting in Portland because we've had these on in a series over the last several years. So it's not just this latest series of protests where you can see this dynamic where the police don't react and don't follow up when far-right militants engage in violence and are extremely aggressive and violent towards anti-racist protesters and anti-fascist protesters, and use the tools of protest policing that we know from past experience only increase the conflict at the protest. So things like kettling and mass arrests and indiscriminate use of tear gas and the inappropriate use of less lethal munitions, you know, not only causing injury for people in the protest movement or in the protest, but not used against people who are doing harm, right? No question there are people in any large gathering who do harm. And what we learned from the studies of protest policing in the 1960s and 70s is that when the police use indiscriminate violence, things like tear gas or you know, not focus specifically on the individuals who are causing harm, it turns the entire crowd against them. And unfortunately, we see the Portland police doing that night after night. And it was fascinating to watch the press conference this weekend where the police chief was being asked why the police didn't respond to the far-right violence that was occurring in broad daylight. And he said, well, you know, police don't want to escalate things. So they understand how their tactics can escalate violence and don't use those in situations where the far-right militants are engaging in violence. But somehow it's fine to use them when less armed individuals at protests are engaging in protest activities and, you know, perhaps violating curfew or dispersal orders, but not involved in the kind of violence that we've been seeing from these far-right militants who are walking down the street with paintball and pellet guns and spraying bear spray and running their cars into people. It's astonishing to watch because I know enough about the previous studies of protest policing that I don't understand what the Portland police strategy is, how they think this continuing behavior, which again has been going on for 4 years, and there have been a number of studies, right? The Independent Review Board put out a study that criticized this apparent bias in how the police reacted to the two different parts of the protest. That draft report quoted a Portland police officer saying that the reason they cooperate more with the far right groups is because their ideas are more mainstream. that's seriously problematic, right?
Yeah.
I mean, number one, the policing should be viewpoint neutral, but number two, it's frightening that somebody in the police would say that. But again, you can see it, and you know, when the next cycle of protests started and this dynamic appeared again, the city invested in an independent review that has still not had any public viewing, right? So, you know, by the time that review comes out, this cycle of protests where the police used exactly the same tactics with exactly the same results, I'm not sure what they think they're accomplishing.
So let's, since we only have about 10 minutes left, so let's talk about the subject of your report, Hidden in Plain Sight, a little more specifically. And there have been reports in 2006, actually under Bush, I don't know if that was kind of a last gasp, called a white supremacist infiltration of law enforcement, which raised alarm over white supremacist groups' interest in infiltrating law enforcement communities, recruiting law enforcement personnel. Then in 2015, a classified FBI counterterrorism policy guide stated that domestic terrorism investigations focused on militia extremists, white supremacist extremists, and sovereign citizen extremists often have identified active links to law enforcement officers. Maybe talk a little more specifically about that and the implications of that.
Sure. So one of the experiences I had as I was preparing to go undercover was a very frank discussion with me about the risks. And one of the risks that was highlighted was, you know, there are other law enforcement officers who are sympathetic to these white supremacists and far-right militant groups. And, you know, we work these cases with the Joint Terrorism Task Force, so state and local law enforcement was involved in the investigation, and I had to accept that there was a certain amount of risk that that information from the investigation could get back to the subjects of that investigation. So, you know, luckily I was working with some really great state and local police officers who I had complete trust in and who did a very good job of ensuring that nothing bad happened to me. But it's sort of a strange thing to hear as a law enforcement officer that the police, that law enforcement knows that there are white supremacist sympathizers associating with the subjects of FBI domestic terrorist investigations, and yet there's no effort in the FBI or throughout the federal government to actually have a strategy for how to identify these officers and make sure that they're not a threat, not just to other law enforcement officers, but to the general public, right? These are people who are given an awful lot of authority and a badge and a gun and are out policing every day with these biases. So when I saw these reports leak you think that would generate questions about where's the national strategy to address this. But unfortunately, there still isn't one.
Well, of course, you know, we know the McCarthy period, which publicly identified communists or alleged communists or socialists and outed them and ruined a lot of people's lives. Of course, we know, as we were already talking about, as more mainstream, that's sort of the closer to the dominant ideology of the United States, so I guess that's not a surprise. But then you have apparently a not insignificant unknown number of police officers who hold these extremist far right beliefs. And so do you know of a single case where somebody's far right ideology or even participation in a violent far-right group or associated group has actually caused problems for a police officer anywhere?
Well, certainly. The report details a number of these cases where somebody's involvement with a white supremacist group, whether they're photographed at a Ku Klux Klan rally or speaking at a white supremacist group's annual event, talking about how they recruit other law enforcement officers. So when these relationships bubble to the surface, the police departments then have to take action, right? There's usually a big community response to that and outrage expressed. But often what you'll find is that their involvement, the officers' involvement with these groups, was well known within the police department. There was no action taken until it reached the public. So the recommendations in the report are that the police departments have to get more proactive about this and have strong policies to make sure that when they discover that somebody in the police department is acting, behaving in this way, that they can be disciplined appropriately, whether that's termination or some other disciplinary action. But what we've also seen is investigative reports that have revealed the racist social media activity of hundreds of law enforcement officers across the country. That Reveal and the Plainview Project have released reports that have resulted in a number of police officers getting fired in dozens of police departments across the country. But many of those officers remain on the force, and there's much more that needs to be done. And prosecutors need to keep track of these officers because they have a responsibility under the law to make sure defendants have access to any exculpatory information the government might have. And knowing that a police officer has engaged in racist activities certainly is something that a defendant could use to challenge their testimony.
Of course, maybe it's something to fear even more than people who leave an open trace, you know, either on social media or you know, photographed publicly, or the people who are not so public and maybe quieter about it and still...
Right. If you're smart enough to actually be not be photographed at a Klan rally but still hold the same beliefs, you can be just as dangerous, absolutely. And
well, do you know how wide... Do you have an idea how widespread it is? I mean, like 1%, 0.3%?
No,
I mean, it's a ridiculous question. Yeah.
Nobody has tried to collect the data, and it's fascinating because it's certainly a minority of police officers. Nobody is suggesting that the majority of police officers hold these views or have these associations, but it's enough of a problem that the FBI warns its own agents who are assigned to domestic terrorism cases that their subjects might have contacts with law enforcement. So if it's enough of a problem for the FBI to warn its own agents, it's enough for the FBI to have a strategy to protect the public.
Mm-hmm. So do you know of any cases in the Pacific Northwest? I mean, Portland had a case where an officer had some sort of like Nazi shrine or something like that, and he's still got his job. In fact, I think he killed somebody too. But anyway.
I talk about that case a little bit in the report, and but there are many others. There are instances where law enforcement officers in the Pacific Northwest have found associating with these far right militant groups, and those cases are sometimes harder. I mean, we all, because of its long that violent history, pretty much everybody in the United States understands what the Ku Klux Klan is, but many of these groups are much newer and have different names and change their names frequently. So we've seen cases where police officers on their police uniforms will put the patch of one of these far-right militant groups. And that's happened during the George Floyd protests. There have been these kinds of incidents. So, unfortunately, when you see these far-right groups coming to these rallies and being treated differently by law enforcement than the Black Lives Matter protesters, it raises concerns that bias is playing a role in this disparate treatment. And,
well,
of course, it's fascinating because these are protests about police bias and police violence and the lack of police accountability. And here we have police departments becoming more openly biased, more violent, and so far less accountable.
Yeah, it seems to be bringing out all the contradictions and divisions more openly. Seems to be part
right.
of what's
right.
happening.
And
so,
I think the point you made is exactly right, that part of it is that there's this divisive political rhetoric going on that contributes to people choosing sides this way.
Well, we're almost at the half hour. Let us know when you need to bow out. One thing I wanted to ask you about, I guess, is the relationship. You know, the Trump sending federal officers here to Portland, the Homeland Security, ICE, these special units, the role of the state troopers. It seems like it's a really complex situation now, and there's a significant component of all of the above, all the different police agencies that seem to have a tendency to support so-called law and order candidate like Trump. Well, where do you see any dissension within the ranks? I guess they tend to keep to that thin blue line. That's a very multi-part question there.
Right. And it was interesting having spent both the early part and the latter part of the 1990s in the far-right movement, because in the early 90s, among neo-Nazis and openly racist white supremacist groups, there was a discussion taking place where people were saying, you know, it's just too hard for recruiting to go out with a Nazi flag on your shoulder and recruit Americans to your cause when we think that they would actually be sympathetic, but the Nazi flag throws them off because of our involvement in World War II combating Nazis. So perhaps we should adopt different symbols and carry the American flag and call ourselves patriots and expand the movement by joining these other right-wing causes and then finding people that we can recruit into the racist ideology. And that was kind of the creation of the militia movement of the 1990s, that there were more people who were calling themselves white supremacists in the early 1990s who were now calling themselves militias. And that was a way of trying to expand the umbrella of their movement. And not that everybody in a militia was racist, not at all. That's not the point. They're trying to reach out into militant organizations beyond their own racist organizations and work together. And so we saw that in the alt-right movement, that they tried to create this new language to broaden the umbrella. And, you know, reaching now, they're going out and going into the Blue Lives Matter movement to try to broaden the umbrella and make them part of the team. And, what I would point out to any police officer is, if you look at who kills police officers, these groups are not your friend. Even if you feel there is a common political narrative and a common enemy, these groups are not your friend. And you shouldn't treat them that way.
Except it seems like there must be strong divisions within those right-wing groups, because certainly a lot of them are openly pro-police. It seems like a small minority that goes to that boogaloo. That seems to be sort of an outlier sort of phenomenon, no?
No, not really. And, no? The thing you have to understand about these groups is, number one, you're right. There are a tremendous number of divisions between them, and they have different ideologies that often conflict with one another. But they're very good at crafting a message that for public consumption that doesn't really fly when they're all alone together in a room by themselves. So they are adopting language that helps them in the short term, but as soon as I heard one police officer say, "Well, you know, the reason we don't react so aggressively against the far right groups is because they're not throwing rocks and bottles at police officers," and it's, of course, they're not throwing rocks and bottles at police officers, because police officers aren't spraying them with pepper spray and rubber bullets and kettling them and doing mass arrests. If you did that to those groups, they're going to respond with far more than rocks and bottles. And there has to be an understanding in law enforcement that their tactics create a reaction. And if their tactic is to let these far-right militants inflict harm on the community, they're not serving the community they're sworn to serve. And that's the problem, is that the police seem to be taking sides in these political protests as well.
Well, I know you got to go. Anything else that you think our listeners should know about this? I guess specifically this new report, Hidden in Plain Sight, or anything else?
Well, just that there are recommendations for reform in the report. So, there are reforms that are necessary at the state and local level, as well as federal reforms, and involve not just law enforcement, but state and local government, and particularly prosecutors, because prosecutors do have this legal obligation to provide exculpating information to defendants. And if a police officer gets put on one of these no-call lists, sometimes called a Brady list, the police department will no longer have use for that person. So even if the police department doesn't want to fire a police officer who's engaged in racist behavior, if that prosecutor puts them on a no-call list, there's no use in putting that officer on the street, because the cases that they bring back to the prosecutor can't be worked. So there are a number of different ways to tackle this that doesn't require the police self-regulating, which we've seen is not very effective.
So that means that this small wave of progressive district attorneys might have an important role to play in this.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you so much. It's been great to talk to you, Mike German. Really appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. And that was Mike German, who's a former FBI agent and currently works at the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program. And as I said, he is the author of a recent report, Hidden in Plain Sight, Racism, White Supremacy, and Far-Right Militancy in Law Enforcement. And that's you can find that at the Brennan Center, Brennan's website, or at my program page, Wednesday Talk Radio at KBOO.FM. So now we've got all about 25 minutes left with just me, 503-231-8187. I want to talk about KABU. I want to talk about our just started fall membership drive, but it looks like we've got a caller that wants to talk. Sean, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning, Paul. Unfortunately, up in my neck of the woods, we've got like Patriot Prayer, Three Percenters, Proud Boys, all these kind of groups. And your guest triggered a couple thoughts that I had. I think there's a commonality between these far-right extremist groups and our financial elites, like the Wall Street elites. And it reminds me of Mitt Romney. He used to talk a lot about the makers and the takers. And I've got this book. I'm sure I heard the authors on KABU, and I went and bought the book. It's called Producers, Parasites, Patriots, Race and the New Right-Wing Politics of Precarity. And I think that the commonality between these groups is that it's a form of what these authors call producerism. So these groups see themselves as the quote-unquote productive members of society, and they see the rest of us as parasites. They see poor people and you know, working poor people as parasites, and they see themselves as the producers. And so you hear that language not only from Wall Street types, not only from the financial elites, but you also hear it from these so-called, you know, far-right populist groups too, that, you know, they are the productive members of society, and, you know, those other people over there, you know, they're the unproductive folks, you know, Antifa, you know, they don't produce anything, quote unquote. When, if they'd been keeping up with current events, in 2008 there was this massive government bailout of the entire economy, and then the CARES Act this year, but, you know, completely bailed out the entire economy again. So it's like this petty bourgeois mentality, like, they see themselves as the productive members of society, as you know, pulling themselves up by their bootstraps, when they're just as much the recipients of government aid as anybody else. They are the moral superior to no one, and yet they see themselves as the producers and the rest of us as parasites, when it's actually, when it comes to the financial elites, it's the exact opposite. So they basically are like inverting Marx. They're trying to say that The financial elites are the producers and the productive people, and all the workers and the poor, we're the parasites, when we all know it's the complete opposite. So I'll stop there.
Right. Thanks. Well, trickle down, you know, it's eventually going to trickle down eventually. But no, I was thinking about that, Sean, as I wrote my introduction. I was thinking, relating to the police, I was thinking, you know, clearly there's racial and gender biases in the police. We've seen that over and over and over and over again. But maybe we don't think so much about economic biases, which, you know, when they're dealing with houseless people, the sort of...
Right.
Yeah, I mean, there's sort of this assumption. I mean, they've got the fairly secure job, very, very secure job, given their protection by the police unions, et cetera.
Exactly.
And, you know, and so they're not making a big salary, but they identify, and they obviously, they know they have to protect property. And so, yeah, I think, like a lot of people look at houseless people living in tents or, you know, cardboard shacks or whatever, there's a sort of that moment of, I mean, I feel it sometimes, and I hate it, you know?
It's this attitude of, like, the deserving and the undeserving.
Right.
You know, instead of a mentality of solidarity, like we're all in this together, it's this mentality of, like, they're the productive and the unproductive. That's like at the heart of all conservative ideology, whether you're talking about Wall Street financial elites or you're talking about the guy driving by in his stupid pickup truck with a gigantic American flag and a stupid Trump flag. It's like they're united on that score of, like, dividing people into the camp of productive and unproductive, of producer and parasite. And I just think we need to talk about that a lot more.
Yeah. No, it's a deep, deep psychology that, you know, it goes back to the origins, whether you talk about, you know, relations with the indigenous people or slavery. It's like you have to, in order to justify your support, you know, the way taking over people's land or killing them or enslaving people, you have to, you know, see yourself as somehow better, and you have to, you know, you have to other them into, you know, oh, they couldn't make it by themselves, or they're lazy or idle. Yeah, it's a deep, deep, you know, or you know, the way the English attitude towards the Irish. Yeah, it's the deep sort of psychological complex of this whatever dominant, you know, society. It's just a capitalist society. Yeah, no, it's always great to hear from you. Last thoughts before I go on to somebody else. Looks like we got Kathy on the line. You still there?
Yeah. Hi.
Oh, now yeah. It's Kathy. Sorry, I thought I was still talking to Sean, but I'm glad to be talking to you, Kathy. Go ahead. What do you got to say?
Yeah, hi, Paul. Thanks for the great topic. Yeah, I wanted to comment that, I mean, I'm seeing the whole country, you know, involved in this incredible, I don't want to say chaos. I really don't think it's chaos, but it certainly is a foment or something. And, you know, what we have as progressives is we really do have the upper hand in terms of, I want to say mental health, that's kind of my background, but, you know, our whole agenda is really great, and we tend to just cringe so much and be afraid, and, you know, especially when, you know, whoever you want to call the occupant of the White House is occupying the White House, and, you know, all these things are going on. It's like we need to give each other more credit for the fact that we really have these good ideas, but they're not well understood. I mean, a lot of the problem here with the police and so forth is just that they don't really get the message. I mean, I love the discussion of the white supremacy thing as being something that they wrap themselves in the American flag instead of the swastika, you know, so that other Americans would accept them. I mean, we need to understand American ideals are really progressive ideals, and we don't have to wrap ourselves in the flag. You know, we are the flag. But if we're going to reform the police, we have to reform so much more at such a deeper level.
It's true.
You know, violent in particular, like, I think part of the reason why the police don't go after the right wingers is because they have ammunition and stuff like that. And, you know, you got to step back and be kind of afraid, whereas, you know, the nonviolent protesters, oh, well, you know, we're probably safe going after them. But, you know, at a deeper level, we need to let the public know as much, you know, whatever opportunities we might have to educate people exactly what we're talking about. Why are we nonviolent? Why is nonviolent conflict resolution so ineffective and really backward in terms of what we know now? You know, of course, the work of Marshall Rosenberg with actually called, you know, nonviolent, what is it, nonviolent communication?
Uh-huh.
I can't remember the exact title of his work, but I mean, just promoting that on a wider scale and, you know, talking about these things, I think might help our issue.
Okay.
That we can't just reform the police department. You know, we got to get really, really way deeper as a society.
I'm not sure I can imagine, you know, engaging in some kind of a nonviolent communication process with, you know, the Proud Boys or, you know,
right.
I actually had tried to talk to them. It's just that the, you know, when people have such a strong ideological conviction that's not open to self-examination, it's a, and they don't, and you don't really interact with them much. We really are, you know, we're more and more separating into enclaves. Now it's, you know, these political enclaves. It's all, you know, it's a, I hear things about, you know, people more and more like going off the deep end into this QAnon stuff, or as our last caller Sean said, he lives in a place where there's, yeah, it's pretty rife with that. But, you know, but how to get the first step, especially now,
right.
Everything's so on edge. So I don't know.
Spreading the word is
a difficult thing when you have such a conflictual situation. I'm not really sure about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think sometimes people call in the KABU, though. I've heard people of other points of view calling in the KABU and starting a dialogue, and they tend to get shut down pretty quickly, which I think is unfortunate. I wish people would really try to kind of maybe keep them on more. I've seen Tom Hartman do some good work with that.
Uh-huh.
On his.
No, I agree with that. I've heard that, and I think, you know, a lot of, I guess, you know, people feel time pressure or, but yeah, no, I think you're right. I think we, you know, there we have precious few places. Unfortunately, some of those people tend to sort of be, you know, not be so open to it, and it takes. That's the problem. It's like once you start it, it's like, 'cause I've started those conversations, and then I don't know. It's like how do you get these deep questions? How do you decide right and wrong? How do you even decide what are facts, what are not? We're in this sort of la la land now where it's, you know, it's difficult to pin things down so that you can actually,
yeah,
have a conversation about, you know, what are people really believing. Anyway, it looks like we got another caller.
Okay.
I'll give you the last word though.
Yeah. I totally take your point, but I think it's important to keep trying. And it is certainly a dance, and you're going to lose sometimes, but I think it is important to keep trying. Especially if you can get them one-on-one in a calm situation. I had a great conversation with a racist last year, and it was really interesting. I mean, he sat there and listened. I was like, you know, why don't you like black people? What do you have against black people? And we had an amazing conversation. It went on for like 20 minutes, and, you know, in the end, there wasn't, you know, he didn't acknowledge anything, but he had definitely heard me, and I think that in the future he may have changed his ways, you know, so his,
mm-hmm.
you know. Anyway, so...
Well, good on you. That's...
Okay.
Yeah, thank you. That's a... Yeah, it's always encouraging to hear stories where there are, you know, is communication happening when it seems this time when it's so difficult. But I hope Marcos is still waiting on the line.
Hello.
To be
yes.
on the air. Hello, go ahead.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
I just wanted to remind Good morning. I just wanted to remind people that the police function under a military-style command structure. It's a hierarchical organization. Individual officers have very little autonomy unless they're not being supervised. And the beliefs of individual officers are not so much important as their actual actions. And I'll give you just an anecdote just to illustrate this. There was a very famous clip that came out at the early part of the George Floyd protest. That was out of New York, where you saw a cop shove a woman hard down onto the sidewalk, and she was injured. Right next to that cop was a white-shirted commander. And in the New York City Police Department, there aren't a lot of commanders. People wearing white shirts are in a high-up command function. That individual officer's actions were perfectly okay in the video with the white-shirted commander. They continued walking down the street without any interaction. So you could blame the individual officer if you want, of course, but that passed muster in the command structure. Now in Portland, our police department, unless they have a coup d'etat, functions under the leadership of the police commissioner. That's Ted Wheeler. He's in charge of the police. There's a command structure, so he has his chief of police. But if the chief of police doesn't do what Ted Wheeler wants him to do, Ted Wheeler will fire him and replace him or her with another chief of police. Every city commissioner we have, Joanne Hardesty, Chloe Udaly, Amanda Fritz, they're all part of this as well. They have a voice. Even though it's not on their desk, as they're not the police commissioner, as commissioners can speak to any issue involving city business.
Right. Well, you also have the problem with the police contract, which details really key issues of hiring and firing, of all sorts of issues that then are there. They're in the contract, and then you've got the police union. I take your point, but it is a little more of a complex situation. There's checks and balances, so that having real police oversight with actual real accountability with real traction. There's a lot of it's. I wouldn't put it all on Ted Wheeler, although obviously, he obviously plays a really important role. So your point's well taken. I just want to respond to your other point about actions and beliefs. I think the point of Mike German was that the beliefs of individual officers can influence their actions in all kinds of ways, in terms of how they treat their colleagues, how they treat the people that they interact with on the street. It can influence who they interact with in their off time, which if they're associating with far right militia people, and then they encounter them at protest, do they have favoritism? I think I wouldn't put it all on the command structure. I think that there's it's an interaction.
Well,
anyway,
it becomes a problem with the command structure if there's a lack of command and control. But that's the failing of the people at the top of the command structure. So
okay.
In any organization that where you have a command structure, if you don't actually have effective control over your staff, then you're going to have problems. But the buck stops with those at the top of the command
structure. Sure. Well, that's why they need to draw up a completely different contract with the police.
But that is
the
political establishment that
I agree. And we seem to be moving somewhat towards that, especially with Joanne Hardesty. So, and the pressure put on by you and I, and
she kicked that negotiation down the road.
Right. And that's all valid. But so the struggle continues, and the more pressure we put on, we interact with those political figures.
My point is, I would hold Joanne Hardesty accountable for the fact that she decided to continue with the current contract and in her in okay. her words were in the interest of transparency. But
okay. Well, that's a conversation. I don't know enough about the circumstances, and so I take your point. And so, yeah, but the ultimate point is keep the pressure on, whether it's Joanne or Chloe Udaly or Amanda Fritz or Ted Wheeler, you know, more grassroots action, more, you know, the current upswell of activism has already led to important changes and possibly lead to more. So direct action and activism and pressure gets the goods. Thank you for calling, Marcos. We got Camilo up next. Go ahead, Camilo.
Good morning. I want to reference Democracy Now! That came on before you and Senator Markey's remarks on his victory over Kennedy. And he made the point that, you know, while we are in serious crises regarding the pandemic, the economy, black rights, Black Lives Matter, the climate crisis continues and worsens. So I fear that we, because of the urgency of these matters, have really neglected what is perhaps a more profound issue. And I think he made the point that none of these issues can be really addressed with any sort of long-term consequence if we do not deal with climate change.
Right, and but that's back to the problem of power, and the problem of power is it. You know, we have an entire economic system. Now we have a political system which has been even further distorted than it was towards the interests of the powerful and wealthy and fossil fuel interests that Trump is making these moves. So the problem is always power and how do you leverage power and to make changes? Because
there's an answer to that question, and it's in the election. Clearly, right. The change in administration will dramatically shift those power relationships. And one of the things that they have power over is our national forests. And our national forests are resources which sequester carbon. And our local resource, Mount Hood, is the sixth largest of all the national forests in terms of the amount of carbon sequestration. But because of the Trump administration, we're still fighting timber sales. He's increased the quota for timber sales. And we're dealing with a forest service plan that is 30 years old. And the organization BARC, which defends Mount Hood, has a campaign to deal with the timber sale to fight and mitigate that as much as possible, and we've been successful at that in the past 20 years. And another campaign to try to update the forest plan, and I think that is something that we want to appeal to KBOO so we can reach out to communities and inform them about how this forest plan neglects climate change entirely because it's 30 years old. And I was hoping that, you know, perhaps we could have a program on that.
Okay, I take that, and I know you've actually reached out to me privately, and I am abashed that I have to be reminded on air, but it's all good. And yes, I am aware of that, and that will be something that we will take on. So I thank you for calling, Camilo. We have one last caller, real quick. If we can go to Jeremy, you got
real quickly
one or 2 minutes.
The Nazi sympathizer wasn't just an officer. He's now an advanced captain. He also didn't just build a memorial to the Wehrmacht or the Luftwaffe or the SS or who knows what, but he collects Nazi uniforms. And he also has been people have won suits against the city for him, you know, beating women during protests. And I was at some meeting trying to get, you know, bicyclists to get along better with cops when critical mass was still a thing. And there was some retiring captain. Kruger was then a lieutenant and about to become a captain. And I said, why can't you get rid of Kruger? This is ridiculous. You've got an open Nazi. And the guy, like, threw up his hands. All right, so that's point one. And it's particularly horrific that he's head of traffic, which has a major role in demonstrations. And the other thing you said is that, well, you know, cops, they don't get that big a salary. Well, when all these layoffs happen, the arithmetic's not that hard. When you lay off eight cops and it saves $1.4 million, that's $160,000 per position. So unless they're all lieutenants, I think the officers are getting pretty well paid. I mean, they have huge.
No, I realized as I was saying that I may not know a damn thing about what I'm talking about. So I'm really glad that you brought that up, because yeah, I mean, compared to what,
you know,
yeah,
somebody with a 2-year degree who tends not to live in Portland, you know, I mean, they're paid well enough to live in Portland. They should be forced to live in Portland. They don't.
Right.
The one occasion I had to call the police, I got this 6'7" guy straight out of Central Casting, you know, Hitler Jungen, who you know, ran a check on my criminalistic tenant and said, you shouldn't be renting to these people. And then I sort of got horrified.
Well,
and then he
said, Jeremy, looks like we got the
You should buy automatic weapons and move to a gated enclave like other white people.
Okay, Jeremy, well, we gotta go. We've got the theme music up, so thank you for calling in. Thank you, everybody else, for calling in. This is Paul Rowland, Wednesday Talk Radio. Bye-bye.
Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Voz Radio, presents our virtual action fundraiser Con la Voz Firme, the power of our voice, on Saturday, September 12th.